Today at Reader's Corner, Beth Macy, author of True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping, and A Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. At the turn of the 20th century, the most popular entertainment acts in the country were found under the big top. The circus offered daring acts of bravery, wild animals, comic antics, and the collection of human oddities known as the freak show. Two of the most popular sideshow attractions were Young George and Willie Mews, African-American albino brothers taken from their family and displayed through a number of circus companies. Their exotic white skin and wild dreadlocks made them a popular act. They were given new names, Eco and Ico, but despite their growing fame, they were virtual slaves to their agent, Candy Shelton, who pocketed all their earnings and told them their mama was dead. Today's guest, Beth Macy, took 25 years to get to the heart of this story, which she recounts in her bestseller, True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping, and A Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South. True Vine was shortlisted for the Kirkus Prize and was named one of 2016's top books by the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, and a number of other media outlets. Ms. Macy is a prize-winning journalist and the author of an earlier book, Factory Man, which we featured in 2015 on this program. She joins us today by phone for this interview. Beth Macy, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back.
Well, Beth, before we get to Willie and George Mews and their travails in the circus and how this all came about, I'd like to point out, I think you gave a brilliant, although that's a tough word to use in a situation like this, account of depicting life for the descendants of slaves in post-slavery America around the turn of the last century into the 20th century. That was a couple of really tough chapters for me to read. Not that I didn't know what was going on by my own reading of history, but the examples you used from True Vine, Roanoke, and surrounding areas just reminded us all over again of what life was like for these former slaves who were trying to still fight their way out of servitude. I wonder if you could start by describing Roanoke in those days and True Vine, more particularly around 1899. What did these towns look like?
Sure. Thank you for saying that. Really, my goal, in addition to telling kind of this fantastic, spectacular kind of wow story, was just to create the world in which a crazy thing like that was even possible. Like somebody could come along and snatch your children. Nobody would help a finger to help you get them back. I mean, how does that happen? So, you know, it didn't happen that long ago. And most of the information I got, while I got some archival information from court documents and census and stuff like that, most of the stuff I got were from people who are still living today. So that shows you it wasn't happening that long ago.
Right.
But life in True Vine, Virginia, okay, first of all, it's a rural tobacco growing community in the southern Piedmont area of Virginia, not far from where Factory Man took place, actually. During the 1890s, around the turn of the last century, when we think George and Willie were first abducted, life for sharecroppers was tough. I mean, the kids never got to go to school because they were busy working. In the 19-teens, Harriet Mews moves to Roanoke, Virginia, which is a boom town at the time because the railroad has located a hub here. This is the city where I live. And people are trying to join the cash economy from sharecropping. So a lot of people are moving from Franklin County to Roanoke City, hoping to get on with the railroad because that was the best work that there was. You know, when you marry a railroad man, every Sunday, dollar in your hand was a popular song. But life in these Jim Crow cities, where there was actually a city code enacted in 1914 telling African Americans where they could live, was in some ways harder. Harriet Mews didn't read. She couldn't vote. She had these children. She was basically a single mom for much of the kids' youngest life. And as I said, nobody wanted to help her get her sons back. It was a really, really tough time.
So tell us at what age George and Willie Mews found themselves working in the tobacco fields.
Right. So probably from a very young age, like 5 and 6, they worked in tobacco fields. The family always believed they were abducted around 1899. The first time I find them in any of the literature, Billboard magazine covered, instead of music, back then it covered what was the largest entertainment, which was a circus. I find them in Billboard magazine by 1914. So don't really know, the records are scant. So we can say that I know for sure they were trafficked for a period of at least 13 years. Their mother gets them back in 1927 in a scene that, is just incredible and also almost suicidally bold of her to go against the greatest show on earth.
I mean, in your book, you even talk about how parrots inflicted hurt on black residents by actually being taught certain racial epithets and then passing them on to kids and white kids who got to ride the school bus, spitting out the windows at black kids who couldn't ride the school bus. This is 2017 now. What's Roanoke look like today?
Well, in the neighborhood that I write about where the Muse family lived, which is the west end of Roanoke, it still is the poorest section of town with a free and reduced lunch rate of 98.something%. It's still a pretty segregated city, not legally anymore, but Roanoke has a pretty small black middle class. The church life is still really important to African-American families, and we've had a nice response to the book in Jordan's Alley, which is the section where the Muse family lived. But you're right. I had to bring a lot of these stories to life through people in their 80s, in some cases 90s. And then, of course, I have the great 102-year-old A.J. Reeves, who is from Truvine and brings that world to life, too. And these people are still living with these memories. 86-year-old, I drove past a grassy lot, and she tells me about, the white family that used to live there. And she and her friends would walk en masse past the house just for protection, because the lady actually trained her parrots to squawk racial epithets at them as they walked to school, because there was no bus to take the black children. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people said, people aren't going to believe these stories. My own grandchildren don't believe these stories, but ain't nobody making any of it up.
You mentioned the age of one or two of the people you interviewed. I was somewhat struck by how many really elderly people you found, over 100 in their 90s. Is this just because you were this dogged reporter that happened to track down every last person who lived to ripe old age? Or is there something in the water there in Roanoke which makes people live longer?
That's right. I don't know. But, I started with the church, because the church is really the central part of both of the communities I'm writing about. And so I went to a friend of mine. She was actually the newspaper's first black reporter. Her name was Joanne Poindexter, first black reporter in the mid to late 1970s. So it took a while. But she happened to go to this church, which was near the Muse family's home. And I said, Joanne, I need help bringing this neighborhood to life in the 20s and 30s. And she said, call Miss So-and-so. And one after another, they brought this world to life, including not just daily life, but also the family. Like, they had connections with the family that was super helpful with me. And because I had Joanne sort of introducing me, I had somewhat of some built-in trust there. But I'm just so grateful to her for doing that. There was an elderly gentleman, he actually passed away about a year ago, named Mr. A.L. Holland, and he's a distant relative of the Muses. He was a 10-year-old boy the day in 1927 when Harriet risked her life to show up at the circus, goes into a sideshow tent, which she isn't supposed to even be in, makes her way to the front, and then claims her sons. And the police came because the circus didn't want to give them back, because they were good money makers. But to have a firsthand account of being a 10-year-old boy, knowing the family, he said it was like the prodigal sons coming home. And he described how everyone in the town, black and white, showed up on their little front lawn to get a peek at them. I mean, there were even curiosities in their own community. And I just feel so grateful that I was able to find these people and to get the story while I could still get it.
So tell us about the circus in those days. What did that mean to a local community when the circus came through, and what was the circus?
Yeah, so between 1840 and 1940, the circus was the number one form of entertainment in America. It was pre-professional sports, pre-TV, film. You know, it was the thing to do. They said Circus Day was second only importance to Christmas Day. And so especially in the 1800s, early 1900s, when factory work was even new, people would save their pennies and couldn't quite afford to go on vacation, but maybe you could save your pennies and you could go to the circus instead. And so in 1927, Roanoke, Virginia is finally big enough to attract the likes of Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey. And even though nobody knows for sure that George and Willie are with that circus then, which they were, they had been initially abducted by their manager who began with carnivals and then sold them from one entity to a bigger entity so he could get more money. And then finally they end up with the greatest show on earth. But when the circus came through Roanoke for the first time, it was on the front page of the Roanoke Times for days and days. You know, everybody's set your alarm clock so you can be there when the train rolls into town. And even if you can't afford to go to the circus, maybe you can catch a peek at them unloading all the animals and the acts. And I mean, it was just a really big deal. You can see that in the coverage leading up to it.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Beth Macy, author of Truvine, Two Brothers, a Kidnapping, and a Mother's Quest, a True Story of the Jim Crow South. So you referred to George and Willie Muse getting into the circus by using the word abducted. But as you get into the story and as you do your reporting, you discover that at least originally you're not exactly sure how this all happened. Help us explain exactly what happened. And then finally, even though Harriet Muse rescues them from the circus, that's not where the story ends.
Exactly. So, yeah, the story I was told the first time I heard the story, I was a young reporter, had just arrived in Roanoke, Virginia, was that these two African Americans with albinism were kidnapped and sold to the circus around the turn of the last century. The family had always been told that. They actually let me do a newspaper article after Willie Muse's death in 2001. And we were able to corroborate this remarkable moment in 1927 when Harriet gets them back and then files a lawsuit for their back wages against Ringling Brothers. But as I delved into the book, as I began really with the family's permission looking at the story and doing more in-depth research, I did find some evidence to indicate or to suggest that perhaps she had initially let them go with a carnival operator. Now, she didn't read. She didn't write. We don't know whether she actually did take out an ad in Billboard magazine, but we do know that the ad that I did find from 1914 says she's ready for them to come home. They were supposed to be returned to her, and it was Christmas time. She wanted them back. And she had no idea where they were. She knew they were being, according to this ad, which, again, we don't know whether she actually could have written or placed or not, since she didn't read. She already knew they were being exhibited as Eco and Ico. So there's all the media examples, all the coverage of them is always cast throughout their careers in a very racist lens. Gets a little bit better towards the end of their careers in the 40s and 50s, but always, especially when this big drama was going on in the 20s when she gets them back, the family was never once interviewed. So that was kind of part of my job, just explaining that in the context of it. So there is some question about, in the very beginning, she may have let them go. The family doesn't believe that. Nancy, their guardian and caregiver at the end of their life, will still swear that based on the love that the brothers had for their mother, all she had was her children and her Christ. Why would she do that? Now, we do know without a doubt that they were trafficked for at least 13 years, unpaid and whatnot. I mean, even the court records, they would have never paid them a settlement had that not been true. Mm-hmm. And but the interesting thing is you would think the story would be all over after she sues Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey in 1927. There's a sizable settlement in 1928. They decide to rejoin the circus. And it happens all over again. After a few years, the checks stop coming home. So this is during the height of the Great Depression. She finds another lawyer and files another lawsuit and ends up, she dies in 1942. But what happens in 1936 is she has a guardianship placed on the sons that results in money being sent home for a trust fund for them. And whenever the checks stop coming, a Pinkerton detective or a private detective is sent out to find them and make the circus pay up. And that was some of the interesting little pieces that I was like, how did she do that? How did the lawyers do that? A lot of the things I found when I was driving around this old neighborhood with these older folks, like they would have, somebody would have one piece of the story, somebody would have another piece of the story. Then I'd find a document and that would relate to something that the old folks had told me. And, you know, so it was this great kind of detective story, kind of just putting together all the pieces.
I was going to say it's a fascinating venture, if nothing else. So getting to the twins, what was life like in the circus for them? They were part of this freak show, but they traveled the world. And at one point you said they even performed before Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, that was what they had always said. We know they performed in London in 1928. I could actually never get, I could never verify that they actually performed for royalty. But they always said that once they knew that their mother was alive, because in the early years they were told to quit crying, your mother is dead. Once they got to see their mother again, and once they knew they could come home and visit her in the off season, they liked the circus. I mean, it was really the only world they knew. You have to assume there's some Stockholm syndrome going on there. But the sideshow, or the freak show, as some people call it, was a place where everybody had some differences about them, whether it was a skill, whether it was a deformity, or what have you. And they always said that there was this pride of calling among people who worked in the sideshow, that one of the things Willie said a lot later in life was they were laughing at us, but we were laughing at them because they were paying to see us. So they kind of, you know, flip it back. And the circus in general was a little bit more accepting than the mainstream society. A number of historians told me it was one of the rare places where gay and lesbian people would work because it was okay there. It was a little bit more accepting. And you can see that their countenance, just in the photographs alone, like in the early pictures in the 19-teens, they look scared to death. In the 20s, in the late 20s, after they're performing with the circus of their own accord, their expressions take on almost like their act is kind of almost comic in appearance. And then in the 40s and 50s, the circus sort of waning then, and they're back with the carnival. And you can tell in the candid shot in the book, there's lots of pictures in the book, and you can see that they're just one of the crowd. And in fact, a writer friend I was with last weekend at the Virginia Festival of the Book pointed out this picture from the late 40s of George and Willie with two female performers. And it's just a kind of a group shot in the circus backyard. And George has his hand on the woman's shoulder. And he said, that would have been very unusual for a black man to have his hand on a white woman's exposed shoulder. But you can tell that they're really comfortable with each other. Mm-hmm. And even in the news accounts, you know, in the latter eras of the coverage of their careers, they retire in the early 60s, they were heralded for being great musicians. And they get a little respect finally in the press. And it's kind of interesting to just watch how their careers evolve. And they retire at the time that the sideshow is waning and really the circus is about to wane as well. And so their careers, you know, had this kind of parallel path.
I was fascinated by their musical talent, which apparently was somehow innate. It's not as though they had instruction, I suppose. And it sounds like from your reporting, they had the ability to play the mandolin, the guitar, the saxophone, any number of instruments.
Xylophone. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. One of their managers, and he was one of their first circus managers, his name was Al G. Barnes. He had a huge Western circus, probably, I'm sure, went through Idaho. He bragged in his memoirs about buying and selling them in 1936. Again, just another clue of just how it was accepted that black people were subhuman beings at the time. And he makes this claim that we taught them how to play music, and they were actually pretty passable musicians, and they were really good musicians by most accounts, especially the later, more friendly accounts of them. But I sent the picture, the first picture I could find of them holding instruments, I sent it to a musicologist, and, you know, he kind of deconstructed the way Willie was holding the banjo and the clawhammer style, which was a style of blues playing that was very popular in Franklin County, Virginia, where they were from. So it's hard to know who exactly taught them, but kind of interesting that this guy who brags about buying and selling them gives himself the credit for it.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with Beth Macy about her book Truvine, which tells the incredible true story of two brothers forced into the sideshow of the circus. So let's talk about Candy Shelton, who seems to be the culprit here, who mistreated these brothers, if in no other way, simply the fact that he didn't really pay them. He took their money and basically held them in what I would call involuntary servitude.
Yeah, exactly. So he's a farm boy from Powder Springs, Tennessee, joins the circus, you know, hey, Mom, I'm going to run off with the circus, apparently, and started out as a candy butcher, which was like, people selling popcorn and candy in the stand. And that became his nickname. And he becomes one of their first managers around 1914 and seems to be pretty ambitious. And he's kind of works his way up. There are accounts of him having dinner with, you know, John Ringling and who was, you know, one of the head Ringling brothers, Lillian Leitzel, famous aerialist, probably the most famous Ringling performer ever. And, you know, he was kind of the in crowd. Once Harriet files that secondary lawsuit that I mentioned in 1936, it becomes really clear that he's the bad guy in the story, to the point that the judge, Lindsay Allman, who would later become the governor of Virginia, not a civil rights guy at all, but he took pity on Harriet Muse. He called her a good old colored woman, and he actually institutes a restraining order to keep Candy Shelton away from them for once and for all. I think that actually happened in 1938. So I had a hard time finding out what happened to him after that. He stayed with Ringling Brothers for a few years. I tracked down some nephews of his who had lived with him in the 50s. He's running a poultry farm in Petersburg, Virginia, of all places. And then he ends up spending his last years in Gibsonton, Florida, which is where a lot of circus performers end up retiring, and a lot of them go in the off season. And I found him, and because my editor was like, "What happened to Candy? What happened to Candy? We know what happened to Georgia Willie. What happened to the guy who mistreated them?" And late one night, when I couldn't sleep, when I was just up doing a Google book search on Candy Shelton, I find this book that's written in 1974. By this really great writer. He writes now for Vanity Fair, and he was doing a travelogue of Florida, just going around interviewing all the strange cast of characters that live in Florida. And he spends a couple pages on Candy Shelton. So there I had it. And one of the great contrasts of the book, and what the family, the niece who took care of Willie in late in life, she always said, no matter what you find out, because I know you're going to find out some difficult things, I want you to remember that in the end, they came out on top. And, and they did. By the time they retired in 1961, they've got a house all bought and paid for because of this secondary lawsuit. And they've got the women and their family totally at their beck and call taking care of them. And you see them go from sort of cautionary tale to wise elder with Willie, especially, who lives so long. He doesn't die until 2001 at the age of 108. And then you've got, as a contrast, Candy Shelton, living alone, a little trailer in Gibsonton, living sort of the sad, lonely life, talking about how great the circus was. You know, he's still very much living in that vein. So I think it's an interesting contrast.
Well, that's why I asked you about Candy Shelton, because when I got to that part of the book, I thought of that old phrase, don't get mad, get even. And I thought, Beth Macy's getting even here. This is telling about this ne'er-do-well who was the culprit of the story, but the twins clearly wind up on top. And speaking of their winding up on top, George, I guess, dies quite a bit earlier than Willie did, but you mentioned 108. Now,
yeah.
We spend every waking day of our lives these days in 2017 listening to the latest report in the newspaper or on the air about what's good for us to eat and what's not good for us and how much exercise we need. Here these two young men are captured by a circus, living in what probably are not ideal living conditions, and I doubt the culinary aspects of their life wasn't much better over those years. And this guy lives to be 108. What's that tell you about all this?
He has albinism, and he has, like, really, really sensitive skin, and he's blind at the end of his life. But I think if you were on the line here with us, and I never got to meet him, which is a great regret, I think he would, you know, he didn't say hello to people when a new person came to the house. Everybody became immediately under a spell. But instead of a hello, he said, "God is good to me." And I think it was that sense of his connection with God and his, you know, they say he prayed before every meal, even if he just had a cookie. And he had this real reverence for life. And even at the end of his life, he was still talking about his mother and the way she risked her life to get them back. He kept a little picture of her next to his bed, and he was totally blind by the end of his life, legally blind at birth, but by the end of his life, totally blind. And he would straighten the picture every night, and he would tell Nancy about his mother. He'd say, you know, she came for us. She could have been arrested. She could have been killed. And he was still remembering that moment under the sideshow tent. Mm-hmm. And I think just that reverence he had and that connection with his God is good to me. I think that would be his answer if he were here to explain the secret of his longevity.
Well, there's one other secret that comes to play at the very, very end of your book. Tell us about the day they buried Willie Mews at 108 in a segregated cemetery in Roanoke, I guess. Mm-hmm. Something happened there at the conclusion of the funeral.
Yeah, so he was, that's a neat question. No interviewer's ever asked me to describe that, but it was a remarkable moment. It was a cold April day. He had died on Good Friday, a few days after he predicted it was almost his birthday. And he said, after my birthday, I think I'll go be with Georgie, his older brother. And so it was actually snowing, and snow had been a big point for the brothers younger in life, because their mother used to make them snow cream, which was the kind of like poor man's ice cream, right, when it snowed. And it snowed, and then a rainbow came out. And a rainbow had also been a big thing in their early years on the circus, because Georgie would point to the rainbow and he'd say, that's God's promise after the storm. And that was something their mother had always told them. And to them, the rainbow represented, like, it was their hope that their mother would still come back in their lives. And, of course, she does in a big way. And at the very end, Nancy released 108 balloons for representing his age. And half were blue for the color of his eyes and half were white for purity.
Can't say it any better than that.
Yeah, and when the rainbow came out, they said it was like God was welcoming Uncle Willie home.
So Ringling Brothers, Barnum & Bailey Circus recently announced it's officially closing after 146 years of entertaining audiences across the United States. Do you have any idea how financially secure that company is? And did anyone over the years in those so-called freak shows ever attempt reparations? Over those years, you have to wonder, did that circus really ever pay up for the people it may have held in bondage over those years?
Not to my knowledge, yeah. No. I mean, you know, they took advantage of the people that they could take advantage of.
Right.
And of course, the people that own it now aren't the Ringling Brothers. It was bought by another company some years ago, long after the sideshow had closed. So you see the sideshow go away in the 60s and 70s as a good outgrowth of disability rights. You know, see children's rights come into being. I mean, at the time George and Willie were first performing, I mean, children didn't have any rights. They were working in factories and whatnot. So a lot of things changed. And this book, I think, is a interesting way to learn about these little nooks and crannies of history that don't always come out when you talk about Jim Crow and segregation. We all know about separate schools and separate water fountains, but we don't know about the gritty, daily, omnipresent humiliation that Black people faced during those years, and that some of these people who are exploited for their labor phase, blacks and whites. So I think it's a new look at an old history.
Well, it's a very good look at an old history, and thank you for doing that. Again, the name of the book is True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping and a Mother's Quest, A True Story of the Jim Crow South by Beth Macy. Thanks for being with us today, Beth.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Next week, Aaron David Miller, author of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.